I next met with Dr. Yelena Janjigian, and to begin, she presented a case from her practice, a 47-year-old man with locally advanced and surgically incurable gastric cancer.
So he started on first-line therapy, and at that time, he was nutritionally relatively compromised, and the data for a combination of fluoropyrimidine and platinum therapy is the strongest, and in terms of response rate and overall survival. We consider addition of third drug, cytotoxic chemotherapy, in select patients, but at that time, due to his disease status and his nutritional status, I did not believe that the third drug would be warranted, and so he started therapy with 5-FU and platinum or a FOLFOX combination. I think it's important to note his tumor was HER2 negative, and therefore addition of biologic agents in the first-line setting was not warranted. Trastuzumab was the only option in terms of biologic therapy, and because his tumor was HER2 negative, we opted to treat him with 5-FU and platinum combination. The patient actually did quite well for some time and has experienced response. He developed significant neuropathy related to oxaliplatin, and approximately after 8 cycles, we discontinued oxaliplatin and we continued the patient on 5-FU maintenance. And so he actually did quite well on 5-FU maintenance and has remained on therapy for approximately a year and a half. So in first-line therapy, that's a pretty good run. And again, excellent functional status, and then suffered disease progression with, again, symptomatic obstruction and pain and discomfort. At that point, he went on to receive second and even third-line therapy. So in second-line therapy, we've done to use paclitaxel-ramucirumab combination. And then he received irinotecan-based therapy. And what we see is, and what I tell my patients, is once the disease becomes chemotherapy refractory, after first-line therapy, we're selecting for treatment refractory clones. So the duration of response and benefit to second and third-line therapies are by definition shorter. So although the patient transiently responded to second and third-line therapy, the response was short-lived and again was punctuated by symptomatic disease progression and deterioration of his quality of life. At that point, we opted to do palliative radiation therapy, so his primary tumor was radiated, again, with little benefit. And that's when, you know, this whole emotional factor of frustration and loss of faith in your oncologist and in medicine in general, and it's an emotional and totally understandable reaction. But that's what we were struggling with. Right around that time, the Cancer Genome Atlas started to become sort of more of an entity that we were aware of. And through research funding and research program, I was able to sequence his tumor. And although the next generation sequencing in metastatic gastric and esophageal cancers have not been at that point fully explored, what we found is that the patient's tumor had a somatic PIK3CA mutation. And the PIK3CA mutations, although considered potentially could be a target, generally, in a heavily pretreated tumor, I would not have recommended a PIK3CA inhibitor, particularly in tumors that are not HER2-driven, that are HER2-negative. But what was interesting is in the TCGA, in the gastric TCGA, 80% of EBV, Epstein-Barr virus-positive tumors, are PIK3CA mutant. So which had me wondering if his tumor was EBV-positive. EBV is not a common pathogen in the West, and it's generally considered to be a rare entity, and therefore it's not routinely tested. There are some histologic abnormalities that may trigger pathologists to test for EBV. It's a relatively straightforward test, but EBV involves testing for EBV DNA by fluorescent hybridization. It's a FISH type of a test. But on small biopsies, sometimes it's hard to clearly see these lymphoid infiltrates and abnormalities that are characteristics of an EBV infection. And so some patients don't have sufficient tumor testing for EBV, et cetera. Luckily, in this patient, we're able to get an EBV test, which was positive. And in parallel, so I strongly encouraged him to get enrolled in a clinical trial that we had open at the time, which was before all the immunotherapy data emerged in esophageal and gastric adenocarcinomas. And he was randomized to receive a combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab on CheckMate 32 study, which is a trial that I recently presented at ASCO. And likely due to his EBV biology and this unique viral entity that can predispose patients to gastric cancer, He experienced complete response radiographically, and on biopsies and repeated biopsies, there was no longer tumor visible on endoscopy. So now he's been 31 plus months on therapy, and ipilimumab was discontinued after the first 4 doses per protocol. And we're in this quandary as to, you know, do we need to even consider therapy? And he's doing well. He has minimal, if any, side effects other than having to come in and, you know, see his oncologist every 2 weeks, which in itself can be an anxiety-provoking endeavor. But he is hesitant to discontinue therapy again because he's so worried about it. He vividly remembers what it was like to be sick from his cancer.
I'm kind of curious, this maybe was a couple of years ago, but did he have MSI testing?
Yes. So actually, NSG Next Generation Sequencing is a 450 gene panel, which is compared to matched tumor. And this is the so-called MSKCC impact, but there are other commercial entities that can do this. And what you do is it's a surrogate for mismatch repair or MMR testing. And what you do is you get a mutational burden, which can calculate the number of mutations per the base pairs that are tested, but also can give you this MSI score. So he was mismatched. This was not an MSI tumor. In MSI tumors in metastatic gastric, and this is another case that we can discuss, generally you see specific types of frame shifts and mutations, but in their report, when you're getting report, often it's a 2-page report all with mutations. So this patient only had 2 alterations in this tumor, a PIK3CA and a KRAS mutation, actually a classic KRAS mutation, which is otherwise very rare in gastric, and it was not an MSI tumor. Clearly, there were very few mutations.
So I'm kind of curious, we'll get back to this case in a second, but at this point, do you consider MSI testing of some sort standard with metastatic gastric?
Absolutely. And so actually, this is a paper that is soon to be published based on our initial experience with close to 350 patients in metastatic setting that we sequenced prospectively at MSKCC. And MSI gastric cancer can be detected on next-generation sequencing and should certainly be done in standard prospective way, particularly these patients, and we have this data that suggests these patients tend to be platinum-resistant. They progress rapidly on platinum-based therapies. And now with the FDA approval of pembrolizumab in chemotherapy-refractory setting in MSI solid tumors, the MSI testing in gastric cancer should be routine.
And in your series, what fraction of these patients were MSI high?
MSI tumors in metastatic series is rare. It's approximately 5%. And this is actually similar to the data that was presented from the KEYNOTE-059 study, which was recently presented at ASCO in metastatic setting. Again, only approximately 5% of tumors are MSI high in metastatic disease. This proportion is higher in early stage tumors. But again, these patients are important to find because you are changing their lives potentially with these therapies, the immunotherapies.
Yeah, actually, I just heard at ASCO, I didn't realize that because I always thought MSI was, you know, fairly high in gastric. I think it was Charlie Fuchs was at a symposium we were doing it. He was saying what you just said, that it's kind of like colon. You see it more in early disease.
The gastric TCGA cancer genome atlas in early stage non-metastatic tumors showed that 22% of gastric tumors are MSI. So this was stomach TCGA, stomach cancer TCGA. When we recently published in Nature this year, 2017, the esophagus and the stomach TCGA together, so these are adenocarcinoma of the esophagus and G junction. Even in early stage tumors, that MSI number went down to approximately 12%. So in US, the esophageal and G junction tumors are more common than the distal stomach tumors. And yes, MSI tumors tend to have a more indolent biology, and it's probably due to the host's immune response and ability to suppress metastasis. Once resected, they tend to not metastasize. However, if you're an MSI patient and you develop metastatic disease, the chemotherapy response tends to be shorter.
Any thoughts about the EBV connection? When you were talking about him, I was kind of flashing on the data your colleague Craig Moskowitz presented in Hodgkin lymphoma. You know, checkpoint inhibitors so effective, and EBV sort of, people don't know exactly what it means. Do you have any hypotheses about why EBV tumors might be more sensitive to checkpoint inhibitors?
Well, you know, majority of these tumors are PD-L1 positive, and they're clearly immunogenic. I don't necessarily think PD-L1 is the best biomarker, immunohistochemistry by PD-L1, but it is a sign of the tumor being more visible to the immune system. And these viral tumors in general, you know, with anal squamous cell carcinoma, although the responses are not as high, but there are 25% response rate. So again, you know, it has to do with your sort of the host factors and ability of the immune system recognize what it has already seen before.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's different, but I always thought it was kind of weird, you know, in head and neck cancer. From what I understand, the HPV positive patients seem to respond as well as the smoker drinker
right.
patients. You know, right. Completely different mechanisms.
Completely. So that's a different, that kind of puts a hole in that hypothesis. And a lot of it, we don't know. I mean, this particular patient got a combination of therapy of nivolumab, ipilimumab, and one could hypothesize that perhaps monotherapy would have been enough, but we really don't know because the combination of anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 tends to have higher responses.
Yeah, I was thinking that as you were presenting his case, I was thinking to myself, I wonder if he would, you know, kind of like the high PD-1 in melanoma, you know, they
right.
maybe you don't really
sufficient.
Need both.
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, you said he did really well, yet he got the combination, which kind of has a bad reputation. And you just reported data on that combination. What did you see? It was just one arm, but what did you see in terms of efficacy and particularly in terms of tolerability toxicity?
Right. So the data you're referring to is the CheckMate 32 study, which is 160 patient esophagogastric cohort, which was completed as part of a larger basket study where patients with, you know, small cell cancer and other tumors were enrolled, ovarian cancer. And so what we saw is nivolumab monotherapy was very well tolerated. And the combination of nivolumab with ipilimumab had higher grade 3-4 toxicities, even at the lower doses of ipilimumab. Most patients, these toxicities were manageable and most patients recovered. There were no colitis or pneumonitis associated deaths, which is what you're worried about when you're giving the high doses of ipilimumab. We did find that the toxicities were mostly asymptomatic LFT abnormalities, blood work abnormalities such as adrenal insufficiency, and abnormalities that could be intervened on if the patient is watched carefully. And particularly in the younger patient population, like this patient, is combination therapies probably relatively safe. And this is, again, part of what we've seen reported with these dual agents. In our disease, in esophagogastric cancer, higher dose of ipilimumab, similar to what was approved in melanoma, seems to be more effective. And if you are going to do combination, it's probably you're better off doing the higher dose because even the lower dose of ipilimumab, there's still toxicities associated with it.
What did you see in terms of efficacy and how does that compare to what we've seen in trials of monotherapy with anti-PD-1?
You know, I've treated a lot of patients on the study and the immunotherapy response to dual therapy was higher. And this is what the data speaks for itself. It was 24% response rate with a combination therapy, which is heavily pretreated third, fourth line patients. I mean, 45% of the patients on the trial were third line and beyond. So these are your only drug left at that point is irinotecan, which, you know, is not going to be very effective. And so to see responses in these patients is quite striking. And again, from the data that we see now, and this was not the design of this trial, so it's hard to interpret it, but it does not clearly translate into improved survival for the combination versus monotherapy. So this question is further being answered and asked in the more prospective phase 3 studies.
Can you go through the numbers specifically in your trial? This is what, a randomized phase 2?
It was a phase 1b/2. And basically, the intent of it was to explore these and to study nivolumab monotherapy, nivolumab 1, ipilimumab 3, or nivolumab 3, ipilimumab 1, and to see the efficacy. The arms were not open all at the same time. Nivolumab was open the longest, so you have the longest follow-up in nivolumab monotherapy. But there were long periods of time where these were randomized arms. So that being said, there were no formal statistics to compare the arms. So there were no p-values or, you know, biostatistical plan. These were supposed to be standalone arms to assess efficacy. And what we saw, again, like I mentioned, heavily pretreated population, majority of the patients progressed on 2 and 45% progressed on 3 lines or more. The treatment of nivolumab monotherapy was well tolerated, and in PD-L1 positive patients, the responses were quite high. The response rates are higher, and in PD-L1 positive patients, again, it's a small number, but 40% response rate in PD-L1 positive patients with nivo-ipi, which is, again, quite hypothesis generating and provocative.
Exciting enough to consider outside a clinical trial setting?
I would say a third of the time when I submit the approval to the insurance companies, they now approve it. I submit the CheckMate 32 abstract. They see me as a first author. And, you know, so I think it's worth a try. I mean, it's not proven, certainly, but outside of other trials, if there's no trials available and there's no other standard options, I would consider it.
What about the issue you mentioned? This comes up in a lot of different cancers about whether to stop therapy. As you mentioned, in this man, he wants to continue. How do you feel about it? If he said, what do you think I should do? Do you think it's reasonable to stop?
Yeah. So, I mean, in him, you know, the answer is easy because he's in a trial. And so we're guided by the trial. But I can tell you the culture has changed in these immunotherapy trials. And most patients stop after a year and then are given an option to resume if there's evidence of clinical or radiographic progression.
Yeah, it's funny because I just started hearing that recently, more and more people talking about stopping preemptively, which I hadn't heard that much. You know, it was sort of the old tamoxifen, you know, if everything's okay, let's keep it going. But as you point out, it's not necessarily a walk in the park. And I guess also sometimes I have starting to hear about delayed autoimmune problems that you see. Have you observed that yourself?
Yes, we do see a higher incidence of hypothyroidism and adrenal insufficiency that patients get. And these are subtle and sometimes present with fatigue. And so if you're not aware and carefully monitoring them, you could miss it.
Can you talk about the other research that's been done using checkpoint inhibitors in metastatic gastric?
So there are several exciting trials that are ongoing. Probably one of the most promising avenues is to try to move these agents in the neoadjuvant or adjuvant setting to try to treat micrometastatic disease. And there are different schools of thought on that, whether or not you need more antigen to be in the body before you can sensitize or respond to immunotherapy. That being said, these are sort of some of the trials both in neoadjuvant and adjuvant setting that are being explored, both in gastric and resected esophageal adenocarcinomas. In Asia, there's a number of trials with squamous histologies. In U.S., squamous esophageal cancer is relatively an orphan, even more so orphan than an adenocarcinoma. But in China and certain parts of Japan, it's still very common. So that's where it's being explored. For majority of our patients in U.S., metastatic disease remains the main battle. And so they're both pembrolizumab and nivolumab and nivolumab ipilimumab are being explored in first-line setting in combination with chemotherapy in gastric.
Can you talk about where you see checkpoint inhibitors fitting in right now in the sequence of therapy?
Yeah. So, I mean, you've seen those data coming from Japan, from Attraction 2. You've seen the data that I presented, that Charlie Fuchs presented at ASCO. There's clearly a tail on the curve, and there's a sort of flattening of the curve, and some people are truly, their lives have been changed with these drugs. But that percent is very, very small. Only approximately 10 to 15% of patients are truly long-term responders and benefit to these therapies. And what we're working on, me personally, but also others in the field, are trying to the best way to identify those patients, because as you mentioned, these therapies are not without toxicity and the cost of them are quite high. And so we need to identify the biomarker to best enrich these populations. MSI is certainly a possibility, EBV. And although PD-L1 helps enrich for a population that benefits, there's certainly PD-L1 negative patients that respond. So that may not be the best and the only biomarker.
Can you talk about right now where you see checkpoint inhibitors fitting in the sequence of therapy? What line therapy should they be used?
Right. Well, so for MSI patients, I would probably use them in second line therapy. Although, again, this will depend a lot on disease burden and the availability of the testing and the drugs. But these patients should be tested in first-line setting for these biomarkers so that you can plan their treatment. And the way I envision it is it's a chess game and you need to plan your strategy out ahead of time. For unselected patients in a metastatic setting, I see these agents being, in the near future, FDA approved, probably in the third line setting.
And from your point of view, where do you think right now, based on the data that we have, it would be optimal to utilize these agents? And I'll ask you, for example, you have an older patient, frail, you're a little bit concerned about giving chemotherapy, they don't have a lot of disease burden, why not give them at first line? It's less toxic than chemo.
Yeah, but it's not available first line. In a first line patient, I would probably not do compassionate release treatments because you have a lot to lose. I mean, these patients do well with monotherapy with 5-FU in a frail patient, and you could even potentially do dose-reduced combination of 5-FU platinum. I mean, these drugs do cause side effects. You know, you can develop acute interstitial nephritis after one dose of anti-PD-1 agent, and then you won't ever get to chemotherapy. And so to do this outside of a clinical trial in a first-line setting, I would probably not advocate for that.
What about second line as opposed to paclitaxel, ramucirumab?
It becomes, you know, medicine is an art. And I always tell my fellows, a lot of what we do is not that straightforward. And so, you know, I'm seeing patients now who progressed on neoadjuvant chemotherapy, progressed on neoadjuvant chemo radiation within, you know, 2 months of completing this, developed liver metastasis. So they're clearly aggressive chemotherapy refractory disease. And so for me to tell them, well, you got to get more chemotherapy, it just is hard to swallow for the patients. And so we try to get them on a clinical trial with immunotherapy. And if there's no clinical trial, these agents are available on compassionate release basis.
You have your 52-year-old patient also looks like MSI high. Is that the case?
Yeah.
Can you just briefly talk about what happened there?
Okay, so this is a woman who was getting treated in the community, and she presented with locally advanced, curable G-junction adenocarcinoma, presented with dysphagia, and had extensive disease imaging that was negative for metastatic disease. So she was started on chemotherapy with radiation, and her primary tumor was irradiated. And while she was on therapy with a cross regimen, which is carboplatin paclitaxel with radiation, she developed bulky metastatic disease. So this is what you would say chemotherapy refractory setting. She was then referred to me for an opinion and management and stayed with me for therapy. She had a large bulky lymph node, which was biopsied confirmed, a metastatic adenocarcinoma, and was starting to quickly get obstructed despite of radiation she was not able to swallow. Required a feeding tube placement. We started her on FOLFOX in second line setting, and it just made her tumor angrier. Her disease, and this is what I was alluding to earlier, MSI tumors tend to really progress quickly on platinum therapy. They are not chemotherapy susceptible to the same degree as the general cohort of patients. So she had a feeding tube in and got admitted, was quite frail, and was really, you know, the discussions were about hospice and best supportive care, unfortunately. So at that time, the nivolumab monotherapy arm was open, and her functional status, she was a young woman, so despite of all of the comorbidities and issues, she qualified for the study. And just after 8 weeks of therapy, so it's nivolumab every 2 weeks, so 4 doses, her lymph node started to melt away, and she was able to swallow first her own secretions, which she wasn't able to before, and then her eating improved and dysphagia resolved. We actually removed her feeding tube, and radiographically she had a complete response. I mean, it was quite satisfying, you feel like, bringing someone from the other side. But again, these responses are rare, and she had persistent disease left at the time of the endoscopy. Her disease started to change and become more from adenocarcinoma to this just poorly differentiated carcinoma, just ugly badness that doesn't have any architecture to it. And she progressed on monotherapy within 14 months of having excellent response. And it's interesting, she only progressed in the primary tumor. So any sites of metastatic disease were still gone and were complete ongoing CR, and only the primary tumor progressed. And so at the time of biopsy, her tumor developed a secondary mutation in the beta 2M, which is a melanoma acquired resistance mechanism. Basically, it's loss of function mutation where the drug can no longer bind and inhibit the pathway. So she's still actually doing okay and alive. We were able to give her another dose of short dose radiation therapy. And I gave her nivolumab ipilimumab combination. I was able to switch her over. And again, she didn't have as good of a response to combination, but the PET scan did get better before radiation even started. And so now, you know, I mean, it's been 4 years since she was diagnosed with her disease. And in the absence of other metastatic disease, her surgeon is actually considering taking her to the OR because she's a young woman who's functionally well and has this permanent issue and is at risk for fistulas because she's been radiated twice. And so this is, again, uncharted territory, and certainly we have to consider it case by case. And I'm not generally a big, you know, supporter of surgery in this situation, but it may be her only solution.
Well, it's an incredible case. When along the way did you find out she was MSI high?
So we biopsied her and sent her tumor for sequencing. And pretty much as she was starting, so I was going to start her on immunotherapy probably anyway, but her functional status was so, for full disclosure, was borderline, you can imagine. And I really had to push and advocate for her. And then when I saw the MSI status, I really kind of just basically didn't take no for an answer.
It's amazing, you know, interviewing people like this in different fields. I've had so many cases I've heard in the last month of people who were considering hospice. And then, you know, I mean, just the idea that you're considering hospice and 3 months later, you're walking around at a human level.
She went back to get her master's.
Wow.
In education. I mean,
Amazing. Yeah. Amazing. You know, the other thing about this case that's obviously really fascinating is why she progressed in the primary. And I'm curious, any speculations biologically? I mean, you mentioned the mutation, but I was wondering, I mean, that was the only area she got radiated, right? Because we sort of have this abscopal thing that somehow it's better. Could you envision that in some way the radiation was part of the resistance or something?
Yeah, you know, I have had cases, abscopal-like cases, where the radiation does help, actually. And in her situation, certainly, she didn't have other sites of disease, so it was hard to assess that. But I have had patients who were progressing, and then we radiated a lesion, and other spots elsewhere started to shrink. Again, it's a little premature to call it an abscopal effect, but there are certain entities like that. I think for her, her tumor, just possibly due to radiation, but also because of just having persistent disease that was bulky and didn't quite go away completely, it just turned it into a zombie. It was no longer an adenocarcinoma. It was this ugly, almost kind of small cell type of tumor that it's like reasoning with a rabid dog. You can't.
Is she currently on the combination?
No. So she had quite a bit of just swallowing still issues and everything. And now her feeding tube is back in, unfortunately, because of this re-radiation and everything. But she's gaining weight and looks well. And so I gave her 4 doses of Ipi and I just stopped. And now she's completely off everything, kind of getting stronger and getting ready for an operation.
Any thoughts about, particularly in somebody with MSI high, particularly because she had this great response, any other kind of immune manipulation? I've heard, I think they're called IO. What am I thinking about?
Yeah, IDOs.
IDO.
There's also LAG-3, IDO.
Right,
there are all of these.
So what are some of the other immune, you know, things that are being looked at that
I think one of the most exciting area is these so-called BiTEs or bispecifics antibodies that are designed, again, to sort of, in combination with immunotherapy, with checkpoint inhibitors, to augment the immune response. And there are bispecific antibodies that are directed against CEA. Josep Tabanero presented an oral podium presentation at ASCO this past summer. And then also, you know, HER2 bispecific antibodies, some of the drugs that are being developed right now. I think it's only a matter of time that these patients with acquired resistance and recurrences emerge, and we have to plan ahead.
So I want to ask you about your 60-year-old man with HER2-positive disease, where I see you had the interesting dilemma that we always talk about, which is second-line therapy. What happened with this man?
Yeah. So in first-line setting, the patient received trastuzumab-based therapy. And then after progression on trastuzumab, the question is what to do next. This patient had no residual neuropathy, excellent functional status. And the question is, do we continue trastuzumab beyond progression? Certainly in breast cancer, there's literature to suggest that this is the way to go. But in gastric cancer, time after time, what we've run into trouble with is taking lessons from breast cancer and pretending that they're directly translatable to gastric cancer. And I applaud these companies for doing clinical trials in HER2-positive gastric cancer, but the design of the trials need to be carefully considered. So as you're familiar with, trastuzumab is FDA approved in first-line setting and showed overall survival, response rate, and progression-free survival benefit. In second-line setting, though, after trastuzumab failure, we already had several negative strategies. T-DM1 failed, lapatinib failed, and again, T-DM1 is a HER2 trastuzumab cross-linked with an also cytotoxic agent called DM1. They compared it in a large trial head-to-head against paclitaxel, and there was no difference in paclitaxel versus T-DM1, highlighting the aggressiveness of the biology of HER2-positive gastric cancer. And so, you know, it's just giving trastuzumab with another cross-linking agent was not enough. And paclitaxel works quite well in our disease comparatively, and so it was not any worse than this fancy new HER2-directed agent.
Was it paclitaxel or docetaxel?
Paclitaxel.
So before you go on, I always pick a bone with the GI investigators about that trial because you all call it negative, and I know it wasn't an equivalency trial.
Right.
But to me, it kind of looked equivalent, but with less toxicity.
Right. But, you could say that.
But nobody
uses
it.
But that was not an inferiority trial. It was a small trial, and you can't, to do an inferiority trial, you need three times as many patients. But you can't go back and, you know, say, oh, never mind, it wasn't, you know, you just can't play with statistics like that.
So I would gather you probably gave this man paclitaxel ramucirumab?
Yep. It's interesting. And so this is, again, data emerging. And I've presented it at ESMO, but also since then, my collaborators in Korea and Japan have replicated this. In patients with HER2-positive disease, at the time of trastuzumab progression, up to 20% of tumors lose HER2 expression. And so actually in this particular patient, I biopsied him and the tumor was no longer HER2 positive. So in that sense, I was also very reassured that paclitaxel ramucirumab would be the right approach.
Interesting. So how did he do on the paclitaxel ramucirumab?
He's still on it. You know, I mean, again, it's relatively well tolerated, but certainly a majority of the patients suffer disease progression. And that's why in third line setting, our options are super limited right now.
I want to tell you about a case actually that we had presented by a general oncologist at one of our ASCO meetings recently. But first, before we get to that, I want to hear about your 62-year-old lady because I think it kind of relates to that. This lady also had gotten FOLFOX for metastatic HER2-negative disease and then went on paclitaxel ramucirumab. What happened when you gave her that treatment?
So in patients who receive doxycycline, neuropathy is a factor. And although with paclitaxel, you don't get as much cold sensitivity, the neuropathy can be additive. And I've had patients, not this patient, but several patients who developed significant neuropathy where paclitaxel either had to be dose reduced or discontinued. Generally, in a frailer patient with neuropathy as a pre-existing factor, I tend to dose paclitaxel every other week, even because of the ramucirumab dosing. And so in this patient, after you achieve maximum disease benefit to paclitaxel, meaning, you know, maximum response on scans and then disease stabilization, I discontinued paclitaxel and continued ramucirumab monotherapy as a maintenance approach.
Yeah, but I see that she had a problem with neuropathy.
Yeah.
So that was occurring off paclitaxel?
No, it happened while she was on paclitaxel ramucirumab.
And so once you stopped it, did you continue the ramucirumab?
Yes, you continue the ramucirumab. The neuropathy improves, but again, because of her prior oxaliplatin, it doesn't go away. Generally, we have them see a neurologist. If it's painful neuropathy, again, mostly from oxaliplatin, Lyrica or agents like that can be considered. Gabapentin, and physical therapy helps manage some of these symptoms.
What do you do with patients who've already had a taxane?
So those patients are rare. Generally, if they've had a taxane, you know, in a neoadjuvant setting, and in that case, there's actually data coming out from Japan saying that you could potentially, if in a patient who've had carboplatin-paclitaxel neoadjuvant setting, they tend to perhaps still respond to docetaxel, although that's kind of not necessarily clear data. And so in patients who have not had taxane, paclitaxel ramucirumab is really the approach. Monotherapy of ramucirumab has been shown to be disease stabilizing, but it has not, in my practice or in the published literature, shown to have significant responses. So it's more of a disease stabilizer.
That's why I want to present my case.
Go for it.
So believe it or not, and I saw the scans, this was a patient, second line gastric cancer, and the doc wanted to use paclitaxel or ramucirumab, and the patient was going on vacation, and she said, can we delay the paclitaxel? And she kept talking him into delaying it until she got her first scan at 3 months and had a significant PR, almost the CR that now continues, I think, 2.5 years later. So my first question is, it sounds like you've never seen that.
We've had some reductions, and I have a clinical trial of actually in HER2-positive disease with ramucirumab, trastuzumab, and with a run-in of these two biologics before we add chemotherapy. And I have seen responses, but there you don't know if it's the combination or if it's the trastuzumab they're responding to. But in second and third line patients with monotherapy, I have not seen any responses.
So this doc hadn't either. So here's what really makes it interesting. Now she's like 2.5 years into therapy, and she's got 2 grams of proteinuria. And I mean, hypertension, but that's, you know, under control. And so his question is, what do you do? I mean, this comes up more like maybe in colon cancer, if it ever comes up. But any thoughts about, he was saying, you know, her creatinine clearance is fine, her renal function.
Just I would leave her on the therapy.
That's what he's...
But I wouldn't change it because honestly, asymptomatic proteinuria in a patient with stage 4 disease, it's the lesser of the two evils.
He actually dose reduced her and she still had the proteinuria and he decided to do exactly.
Full disclosure, I don't monitor proteinuria.
Yeah, that's probably even a better idea.
Just don't look. Oh.
Anyhow, I wanted to ask you also, your 70-year-old lady with a history of heart failure. Can you talk about how she presented and what the issues were with her?
So this is an interesting case because the question comes up and I still, you know, when I speak to the fellows or folks in the community, these patients, the combination therapies in elderly patients. So this is a 70-year-old woman with heart failure and although well compensated and right upper quadrant pain and was found to have anemia and albumin of 3.0, which is generally considered to be a negative prognostic factor in patients with metastatic disease. And so the question here is what's the appropriate agents to use? And certainly some of the literature historically has advocated use of 3-drug therapies in metastatic gastric cancer. It's important to note that this patient has multiple comorbidities and, you know, drugs like anthracyclines and taxanes would probably exacerbate her functional status and you may not be able to get additional lines of therapy in her. So in a patient like this is a perfect example where combination therapies of 5-FU and platinum, and again, cisplatin should be avoided. Oxaliplatin has just as good of a track record in terms of efficacy. And it may not be very sexy, but FOLFOX is really the best option in some of these patients.
And so what happened with this lady?
You know, she did well. Again, we had to do multiple dose reductions. And generally in elderly patients, I started at lower doses. But she responded and clinically her albumin improved and she started to eat and she tolerated the combination therapy well.
So you had a really great paper in the Annals of Oncology, New Agents on the Horizon in Gastric Cancer. And of course, you went through checkpoint inhibitors that we've already talked about. But there were a couple of agents and strategies that you mentioned in the paper I wonder if you could elaborate on. And one is something I've heard about for a long time and kind of wondering whether it's ever going to end up in practice, which is the concept of stem cell inhibitors, particularly the drug napobucasin, which I think it used to be called BBI-608. Can you talk a little bit about what these kinds of agents are and what we know about this strategy?
Yeah, so the stemness, this whole cancer stemness, the idea is that the progenitor cells to the cancer are hard to eradicate with chemotherapy. And if you target the stem cells and the stemness of it, you will help eliminate and treat the cancer. So these agents are being explored in combination with chemotherapy. And although this is an interesting avenue of investigation, certainly right now it's not prime time and we're still awaiting clinical trial data. One of the other class of drugs that are also up and coming are these claudin inhibitors, claudin 18.2 rearrangements, were actually noted in the genomically stable or this diffuse gastric cancer cohort in the TCGA. And what's interesting about this protein is that it's a cell adhesion protein. And again, you know, historically, the signet ring cell type gastric cancer, or these ecuadherin-driven gastric cancers, have been very challenging to target. They generally don't respond as well to chemotherapy. The patients develop peritoneal carcinomatosis and become quite sick. And so these claudin rearrangements could be, you know, the way to target these drugs. The phase 2 data that was presented at ESMO was very promising. But again, we've been burned by phase 2 data in the past multiple times, including MET inhibitors and so on. And so actually the phase 3 trial is being planned even as we speak.
And there is like a predictive marker that's used?
Yeah, it's immunohistochemistry for the protein, and it seems to be a relatively useful biomarker.
What about tolerability issues both with this agent? I mean, would you consider this, I guess it's a monoclonal antibody targeted type therapy? Would you look at it that way?
Yeah, it's a monoclonal antibody. And, you know, the original study used anthracyclines, again, as a backbone. And I think in combination, you know, actually, between our institution, MD Anderson, and others in the field, we put out a statement in JCO trying to put a stop to use of anthracyclines in metastatic setting. And so it's a difficult backbone to build on. And biologically, there's really no rationale to use it for the claudin inhibitors. And so I believe that the drug should be relatively well tolerated in combination with two drug cytotoxics.
We were talking before about napobucosin. What about tolerability issues with that? I've heard about GI issues.
Personally, I haven't really treated anyone with the drug, but I think we only care about tolerability if there's any sort of sign of the drug being effective, and I think that jury's still out.
Do you sort of buy into the mechanism involved here?
You know, I think it's a very provocative and interesting and scientifically exciting mechanism. Whether or not it will be the way to treat our disease, you know, we still have to wait and see.
So you also have a case here of a 68-year-old lady. Maybe you can go through that one. Former smoker, epigastric discomfort.
So this case one is a locally advanced disease, and again, goes into the difference between, you know, the tumor location and driving the type of operation and the type of neoadjuvant therapy that we would recommend. So this was a 68-year-old woman with a locally advanced endoscopically on the endoscopic ultrasound was a T3N1 tumor. And the question is, you know, how would you stage this cancer? And how would you approach the treatment? So for majority of these patients, it's important to rule out metastatic disease. And even on the CT scan, often, if the CAT scan is negative, we can pick up occult metastatic disease in 10 to 15% of the patients by FDG, fluorodeoxynated glucose PET scan. And so these patients tend to develop metastatic disease to supraclavicular and retroperitoneal lymph nodes, which you can miss on the scan. And also in a patient who presents with weight loss and symptomatic cancer, even in patients with a PET scan negative for metastatic disease, a laparoscopy is necessary to rule out occult peritoneal carcinomatosis, particularly in patients where the majority of the tumor is in the stomach. So this patient had a perioperative laparoscopy, which was negative, no evidence of peritoneal disease on the PET scan, and then the primary tumor, the standard uptake value was quite bright, SUV of 14. So what do you do for this patient? And generally, there's a lot of consensus to show that something more than surgery needs to be done. If the tumor was mostly in the esophagus and the higher portion of the GE junction, the consensus is that chemoradiation should be the standard. In this patient, however, the majority of the tumor was at the bottom portion of the GE junction and extending into the stomach. So your classical gastric cardia proximal sort of tumor where the radiation generally is not indicated. And there's some, you know, sway on this data, and certain academic centers still advocate radiation for it. But I would not radiate this tumor, and we elected to treat her with preoperative therapy. Then the question comes up, and actually since this patient was treated, the data has changed. You probably saw Albatron present the FLOT4 data at the ASCO 2017 meeting. And so in this patient who is otherwise fit and is able to tolerate 3-drug combination, with the current standard, it would be a combination of 5-FU, oxaliplatin, and docetaxel, or the FLOT4 regimen. Before the data came out, you know, the OE05 data, which was presented by Cunningham, showed that epirubicin, or EOX-based therapy, did not do any better than FOLFOX or 5-FU platinum. And so for this patient in particular, she received FOLFOX as a preoperative treatment.
Do you want to elaborate on that? You mentioned the editorial that you wrote about, you know, the issue of anthracyclines. Can you comment on that?
You know, we need to move this field forward, and the only way to move a field forward if there's a consensus among experts. Until last year, there were still at these meetings and scientific consortiums a lot of discussion back and forth what to use as backbone for clinical trials and so on. And so there's this perceived disagreement. So Jaffer, Johnny, and I thought it was very important to come together and write a statement piece about what, you know, we as experts think and agree on. And so it's basically a summary of pertinent highlights of recent negative studies, including the CLGB study of FOLFOX versus carboplatin or irinotecan versus ECX. So the consensus statement was basically to summarize and to show that there's no benefit for addition of epirubicin in metastatic setting, and it should be avoided, and it will help us sort of consolidate all the efforts and advance the field forward if we can agree on what the backbone should be in metastatic patients.
So getting back to your patient, what's her current situation?
So she went on to have surgery. So we actually tend to use the PET scan as an assessment of biologic response. This is based on Florin Lordig's data in the Munichon trials showing that the patients who don't respond to first cycle or 2 cycles of FOLFOX, and the response is defined by change in SUV on the FDG by 35% or more. So the tumors that don't respond biologically represented more aggressive tumors and should probably either go on to have surgery, or there's also an Alliance trial that looked at switching therapy. So this patient had FOLFOX, responded beautifully, and then went on to have surgery and had 99% treatment response. Again, unusual scenario in this disease, but she had an excellent response. And then there's a conundrum. So she's elderly, she had a complete gastrectomy, total gastrectomy for a proximal tumor. Most of these patients lose up to 10 to 15% of their body weight in the post-op setting, and so nutritionally quite compromised. And so you're seeing this patient who now has a YPT1B N0 tumor, so downstaged from T3N1 tumor, and she's asking you, what should we do? And obviously she is thankful and wants to capitalize on this response and does not want to have her cancer recur, because once it recurs, obviously it's no longer curable. But these in adjuvant setting, even the FLOT4 data and other clinical trials data shows that half of the patients only are able to receive therapy if we're lucky. And so in this particular patient, she rallied, she did well. She didn't gain weight, but her weight stabilized. And then, you know, because she was motivated and she has a grandchild on the way and everything, you know, a lot to lose and at stake here, we elected to do 3 more cycles of FOLFOX.
And I'm curious what you would predict her prognosis to be, her chance of relapse at this point.
It's a very hard number to predict. And what I tell my patients is they're cured and they should feel they are, and everything else is inconsequential. They shouldn't be Googling numbers and et cetera. But obviously with no negative disease, her chances of recurrence are substantially lower, but they're not zero. And there are new emerging technologies to try to sort of predict when to stop chemotherapy, which patients are less likely to recur. I'm particularly interested in that field and using cell-free DNA as a biomarker to try to hone in better on this risk of recurrence.